It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later in the program, we'll begin our series on heroin in Wisconsin and the problems stemming from the drug.
But first, over the weekend, a verdict came down in the case against George Zimmerman, a former Neighborhood Watch volunteer accused of murdering 17-year-old Trayvon Martin.
After weeks of testimony and months of national media attention, Zimmerman was found not guilty by a six-person jury.
Joining us to discuss that verdict is Charles Rose, professor at Stetson University College of Law in Florida. Charles, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Now, let's start with the verdict. Was it a surprise to you?
Not at all, right? It was not a surprise because of the nature of the way the case got to trial and the evidence that was actually presented.
Now, why did prosecutors opt to charge this as a second-degree murder?
Well, you'd have to ask the prosecutors why ultimately they made that decision, but it's easy to posit that there was at least some degree of political pressure. There's a very different feel to a manslaughter case as opposed to a murder case, because in manslaughter you don't need to prove intent in the state of Florida in the same fashion. And I think they believed the story that Mr. Zimmerman sought out Mr. Martin as a victim. The problem with that belief was it wasn't backed up by evidence.
Now, in the news, of course, this has been treated as a story about guns, about race, and about civil rights. When you get into a courtroom, how do you separate that out from just the facts before them and how they accord with the law?
Well, that's the judge's job. The attorneys push for the amount of emotion or issue to present before the jury based upon their theory of the case. The state wanted to get into profiling and to potentially raise the shadow of some sort of racial bigotry on the part of Mr. Zimmerman. The problem was they did not have the bona fides to put before the judge to get the judge to agree with them. So they were left with the argument that he profiled Trayvon Martin because he was wearing a hoodie and was walking through the neighborhood. And that's not that's nowhere near the concept that is in the minds of the public right now, that this was somehow racially motivated.
And the big thing here is that they have to prove a case beyond a shadow of a doubt, is what we hear from the courts, or at least the courts as presented on TV. Was that a tall order for the prosecution?
Well, beyond a reasonable doubt means that you don't have any doubt that's reasonable that the government has proved their case. And in this particular case, you wound up with exactly the opposite. The defense was able to literally prove that Mr. Zimmerman was acting in self-defense. So the pendulum swung about as far outside of the norm as a criminal trial goes.
Now, one of the big controversies here is over the stand your ground law in Florida and in other states. Was that a factor in this verdict?
Well, it was a factor in the verdict in that the stand your ground law, when the crime initially occurred, led police to know that they probably couldn't charge this case under the stand your ground statute. It never actually played out at trial because the defense chose to raise self-defense instead of stand your ground. Because if they'd raised stand your ground, they would have had to do a pretrial hearing and the state would have learned their entire theory of the case. And they didn't want to do that.
And were there issues with the initial investigation that made it hard to establish the facts for use in this trial?
No, actually there were not. The initial investigation done by the local sheriff and the county supported what ultimately happened the day of trial. That statement has been made by the prosecutors who ultimately tried the case. What they're really saying is we didn't get to develop our evidence the way we wanted to. There was actually a greater problem with the involvement of civil attorneys on the part of the Martin family going out and getting witnesses, because civil attorneys don't understand criminal practice, and they contributed greatly to the embarrassment for that one young girl who was actually on the phone with Mr. Martin the day that he was shot, because by the time she got to trial, her testimony was useless.
Hmm. Now, I always wonder, in such high-profile cases, as they're interviewing jurors and both sides are trying to make sure they don't get somebody they don't want on that jury, how big a problem is that to get, I guess, untainted jurors on the court?
Jury selection is the most difficult thing that trial lawyers do in an average case, because you are literally talking to the folks who decide the issue completely and over whom you don't have control. When you add the emotional impact of the death of a child, and then on top of that, the racial turmoil within the nation as they look at this case from the outside, you're really, really worried about it. But we should be comfortable. This jury deliberated for over 16 hours. They went through every piece of evidence that was available. They worked through the statutes and ultimately came to a reasoned conclusion, whether you agree with it or not.
I think a lot of people in the country are looking to this case, however they looked at it, as a referendum somehow on gun laws or on race. Did that happen? Is there a referendum, or is this just a case that was a case itself?
I think it was very much about the self-defense laws in the nation and gun laws, and had very, very little to do with race. If we did not have Stand Your Ground in the state of Florida, the circumstances that led to these events turning out the way they did would have been very different.
Now, of course, this has been all over the national media. You're down there in Florida. How high profile has this been there, much less the rest of the country?
Well, I can tell you that I spent an hour and a half on a local television station the day this verdict came out explaining it to the public. It has been very highly watched and considered within the state.
And has this led to anybody saying, any likelihood that there will be changes in things like the Stand Your Ground law or how self-defense is treated in Florida law?
Well, the governor appointed a commission to review the Stand Your Ground law after this event occurred, when Mr. Martin was shot, but the commission ultimately came back with no major changes, no major recommended changes.
Charles, thank you so much for joining us today.
Glad to do it.
That was Charles Rose, professor at Stetson University College of Law.
Coming up next, it's a look at the severity of Wisconsin's heroin problem. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
A dangerous drug once thought to be relegated to the back alleys of Milwaukee or Chicago is reemerging as a serious problem for Wisconsin. In the first of Central Time's six-part series examining Wisconsin's heroin epidemic, Rich Kramer reports that the drug, which had fallen off the radar screen for many law enforcement agencies, is coming back strong and spreading through smaller rural parts of the state.
You know, it still smells like her in here, the sweet pea.
In Karen Hale's home in Hudson, a young girl's bedroom remains frozen in time. This is where her daughter, Alyssa Ivy, struggled with heroin addiction.
But you'll see, if I point it up, which is sad, you can see the blood spatter marks up on her ceilings. You know, you look up there.
From what?
Injecting, hitting a vein. That's what happens with heroin.
Alyssa died from an overdose at a nearby hotel in May. She was 21. Karen says she and her daughter put everything they had into fighting the addiction, but it wasn't enough.
Unfortunately, I lost in this battle, and a heroin won out, and I hate it for that. I hate the pain, and I still keep waiting for her to come home, but I know she's not ever coming home.
In the last 2 years, seven people have died from an overdose of heroin in the Hudson area alone. According to the latest data, 134 people died the same way across the state in 2011. In 2007, 38 people died. So what's behind this epidemic? Department of Criminal Investigation Field Director Dave Spakowitz says it can be traced back to people's addiction to prescription painkillers. He says drugs like OxyContin have become extremely popular, but in recent years, doctors have been more careful prescribing them, and drug takebacks have kept them off the street.
So now you took all that source of supply. They're not in the medicine cabinets anymore. Doctors don't prescribe them as often. The cost. So all of a sudden, we're seeing people go to heroin because they had that level of addiction.
And Spakowitz says this drug is everywhere.
People have to realize that heroin is here and it's happening in their community. It's not a big city thing anymore. And people are dying as a result of their dealings with heroin.
While heroin is a problem in Milwaukee, Madison, and the Fox Valley, smaller, more rural communities are now faced with a drug epidemic they didn't expect. Dan Ault is police chief for the city of Oconto, which has a population of around 4,500 people. He says 2 weeks into his stint as police chief, people were finding syringes in parks, but there weren't any heroin arrests being made.
Heroin was, I believe, being missed. I think it was a lack of
awareness that this drug had hit and how fast it hit the area.
About an hour to the west, Shawano County saw the same trend. Heroin is now the drug that investigators are spending the most time on. And Sheriff's Department Captain Tom Tuma says heroin isn't a drug that discriminates.
There is no one socioeconomic group that this drug is unique to. This is a problem that truly crosses all borders and is insidious. And people of all walks of life and professions are finding themselves in trouble with.
DCI heroin expert Dave Spackwitz says police can't arrest their way out of the heroin epidemic. He says it will take more treatment and community support, even though budgets are tight. The State Department of Justice has announced a new initiative and grants to help local law enforcement fight heroin, but Spackwitz still expects the heroin problem to grow. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks to Rich for his reporting. And through the week and into Monday at this time, we will hear other reports on the state of heroin and how it's affecting us here in Wisconsin.
And here to talk with us about the heroin epidemic in rural Wisconsin is Sheriff Jerry Sove of Marinette County. Sheriff Sove, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, can you tell us about your experience with opiate use in Marinette County?
Well, we have a real issue with it here. I think it traces back to about 2007 when we had a doctor in Menominee who was eventually federally indicted and convicted, was doling out prescription medications, heavy doses of oxycodone and hydrocodone, those type of medications to people that really should not have been given them. I think that's where part of our problem started. When he went away, that source dried up. And a lot of these people turned to heroin use because it had become affordable and it was a replacement for that.
And do you have any idea, besides that doctor, why since then it has taken off in Marinette County?
Well, I think that was part of it. And then I think that it just became affordable and it became something that people tried. And then what we've learned is it's just so highly addictive that once people take it, they tell us, some of them, that they just have to have more and have to have more, and it becomes their life. And it's a type of drug that it is causes them such illness and just being sick if they don't get some more, and they don't want to feel like that, so they'll do just about anything to get some more.
Now, we know that the people don't function in vacuums. They're connected to networks of other people and to the community. What kind of challenges has this created in the community around Marinette County?
Well, it's been a real plague for us. It causes several issues for us. Number one, which I deal with a lot, you know, we have a law enforcement center here in Marinette County that's 10 years old, and we built this facility. I did not think that we would have jail overcrowding issues, but we do. A lot of what we see are heroin people in our jail, and they're clogging up the system here. That's a big part of our issue. So we've got jail crowding issues. It's been a real challenge for our medical and emergency medical response people, where they have had to use this drug Narcan to bring several people back that would have otherwise died. The ER sees way too many people in there for abuse of opiates, and so the medical system is taxed. Our Health and Human Services, is also affected by dealing with the fallout from this, because these people get so wrapped up in this drug that they neglect their families, they neglect their children and even their pets at times, and it's really sad to see. And, of course, our coroner and our the people that deal with the bodies. I mean, that has been an issue also because we certainly have had our share of overdoses.
Hmm. As sheriff of Marinette County, what is it that you're trying to do to try to combat the problem?
Well, we are making a commitment to keep personnel on the point of this drug effort and on point with the intelligence, and continuing to follow up on information that we do receive and to make cases. I'm certainly not flush on personnel here, but As long as I have something to say about it, I'm going to keep somebody on the point and working exclusively on this issue, because we know it's there and we know the collateral damage it causes. You know, when we've seen so many terrible things as a result of this, not only property crime to support the habit, but the spinoff and the neglect of children. And I mean, to the point where we know that there have been instances of young women that have been willing to prostitute themselves to obtain funds to buy more drugs.
Hmm. Has it touched you personally at all beyond what you're seeing in your job?
No, fortunately, no one in my immediate family or anything has been affected by it. But I think what the public maybe doesn't understand about this issue is how expensive it is for us to continue to work. We are incurring overtime costs, court time. It's just a very expensive thing to investigate and continue to try and stay on top of. And, you know, if we're on top of it, perhaps we're on top of the tip of the iceberg, because there's certainly a lot of work to be done, and I could have a half a dozen more investigators working on this, and we could be going around the clock, and sometimes we do.
Have you made any inroads so far, or do you think the use is as high as it's ever been?
No, we certainly have. We're making cases all the time. We just recently took down some higher-level people, and that was an interstate investigation. And it's the type of thing where the public doesn't, you know, if we clear up a string of burglaries, we can show the fruits of our efforts, if you will, much easier there. Say these people have been arrested as a result of the burglary investigations. But with this type of work, it is covert and undercover. And so often, I can't make public who's been arrested because it affects the integrity of spinoff investigations.
Hmm. Well, what is the most important thing that you want people to know about heroin use?
I think it is that if anybody is intrigued by it and tempted to in a situation where there's a possibility to say, well, I'll just try it, don't do it. Because we have seen and talked to a lot of people that said that one time, I wish I wouldn't have done it, because it is so highly addictive, and then it just starts controlling people's lives.
It seems like you've seen some heartbreaking things, and I'm guessing that dealing with the fallout from heroin use is not only difficult to see, but that it's preventing you from doing other work, too.
Yes, on both parts of your question. It is difficult to see what the families of these heroin people go through. It's painful to watch court proceedings when a judge is sentencing somebody to years in prison, and they're throwing their young life away, and watch parents, you know, crying because they've done their best to. And it's now they're watching somebody go to prison, and it's also very difficult to see how some of these people end up living and neglect children and so forth as a result of it. They just get consumed by it. And it's also one in which that it, you know, if I didn't have this, you know, we could certainly turn our efforts towards other type of law enforcement efforts that need attention also.
Well, Sheriff Sauve, I wish you well, and thank you so much for joining us on Central Time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Marinette County Sheriff Jerry Sauve. Coming up tomorrow, as we continue this series on heroin in Wisconsin, we'll hear about the role that prescription drugs play in the state's heroin epidemic.
And don't forget, you can keep up with us, find out what we'll be covering, and leave your thoughts at the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about racial divisions in the United States in the aftermath of the George Zimmerman trial.
And we'll look at an effort by Sesame Street to help kids whose parents are in prison or jail. One of the people, one of the main consultants on that, is a UW-Madison professor. She'll be here to tell us what kind of help kids need and how to talk to kids whose parents are incarcerated, who are in jail or are in prison.
And another thing we'll be looking at tomorrow is the trend nationally for grandparents to have a huge hand in helping to raise the kids. I know that's a case in my family. Mm-hmm. I think it's in the case in yours
in
as well,
too.
Rob. So this is not just us, though. This is a national trend. We'll be looking at that and finding out what's happening and how the American family is changing around it.
And then we're going to have some fun and talk about tattoos, a new museum exhibit, and we're hoping to hear about your ink. So that's all coming up tomorrow. Right here on Central Time, here in the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You might remember this piece of music, Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake, from the 2011 film Black Swan. It won Natalie Portman the Academy Award for Best Actress and was a box office success.
The film also gained notoriety for its role in the case of Glatt versus Fox Searchlight Pictures. Eric Glatt, who once worked as an intern on the set of Black Swan, sued Fox for violating the laws of unpaid internships, and he won.
Eric is here with us today to talk about the ethics and value of internships, and we'd also like to hear from you during this segment. Have you or your children worked as interns, and was it a valuable experience, or maybe more bordering on exploitation like Eric's experience? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Thanks for joining us, Eric.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So tell us, how did you find yourself involved in the midst of this debate over the ethics of unpaid internships?
Yeah, I mean, I came to work on the motion picture Black Swan, and basically I was shifting into, you know, a new career track for myself, and I came to realize that unpaid internships were the established way for people to get started in a lot of different fields. So I accepted that one. And it was really only by sheer coincidence, towards the end of the internship, the Department of Labor issued a fact sheet summarizing the rules that would really apply to having an unpaid worker on your work site. That is, if they're really only there because they're being trained at something. And the New York Times picked it up, and I just suddenly realized this wasn't some sort of gray area. This wasn't something that had to do with students. It was really just, it'd become a form of wage theft. And I had a lot of difficulty trying to, you know, get the next job after that, the next job after that. And I realized part of the difficulty I was having as a freelancer in the film industry was the fact that producers had come to rely on slapping the word intern on a job description and feeling like they don't have to pay for it.
So you're reading those rules, and what hit you that you were doing that you weren't supposed to be doing as an unpaid intern?
Yeah, I mean, the rules are really, they all go back to a Supreme Court case from 1947. The minimum wage law, the Fair Labor Standards Act, was relatively new still. And this case came before the Supreme Court. It was a one-week training program at a rail yard. And the employers said, hey, look, you know, we got this new minimum wage, but do you really feel like we have to pay people who are here just getting training from us? It actually sometimes impedes our operations. We're not benefiting from this in any way, shape, or form. The only thing we get from it is having a better trained labor market in general, a better workforce in general. And the Supreme Court made a very common sense, you know, decision and said, you know what? If the employer's not benefiting, if it's all for the trainee, there's nothing about it that really ties that trainee to that particular employer. And really the important thing is, you know, there's no benefit accruing the employer. It's really something where they may even have their operations impeded because they have trainees there and they have to dedicate resources and staff to supervising them. If you meet all these criteria, of course, it doesn't make sense to pay the minimum wage, right? So that's the standard, whether people know it or not. That's the standard that employers are implicitly using when they call someone an intern and feel like they don't have to pay them. And most internships that I've ever seen do not meet that standard.
Well, you can see why in the glamour industries, and film is one of them, that you would be hesitant to kind of stick your head up and say, hey, I'm not getting a lot out of filling the coffee and, you know, making copies of things. Is it harder in certain industries like the industry that you were in to take a stand and look at this?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's increasingly prevalent in a lot of other sectors of the economy as well. I live now in Washington, D.C., where the government makes heavy use of free labor, it calls interns. But, yeah, I think that, you know, you said glamour industries. I say culture production industries. They're not niche industries. These are big, mega million-dollar earning corporations. They're net exporting industries. These are meant to be sort of representative of, you know, knowledge work and where our economy goes in a post-manufacturing society. And, you know, the idea that there's a lot of fuzzy value in it, that people think it's sort of exciting or interesting, or maybe it even looks like something they once did as a hobby. Therefore, it doesn't look like, you know, a job my grandfather had, shoveling coal in a foundry or working on a factory floor. It doesn't look like labor in the way that people traditionally think of it, but to the employers and the people who own these companies, it very much is. It's value-adding labor. And I think what we really need to do is start thinking about it in terms of, you know, what does our economic, what does a vital, sustainable economic structure look like when we're not talking about factory work, but we're talking about culture production work?
But out there, there are a lot of maybe Eric Glatz who want to get their foot in the door in the industry, and they'll say, you know what, I know I'm being exploited. I know they're getting value from me for free, but I think it's worth it to make some contacts, get this on my resume.
Well, that's one of the ways that this is really, you know, one thing that's so upsetting about this is it institutionalizes class advantage. If you can afford it, I came from a different industry altogether. I'm relatively late to my unpaid internship. I was 40 when I did it. And if you can afford to do it, or more likely, as is more often the case, your parents can afford to support you while you work for extended period of times for free, yeah, it might work out for you personally. But would you take that job if you knew it was actually taking pay out of someone else's hands? I mean, because that's really what this amounts to.
So tell us how your case proceeded after you filed it. I know, you know, you might have been worried this was the industry you wanted to enter. Were you worried about repercussions there?
Yeah, I mean, I'd worked in the industry before, mostly on, you know, smaller documentary films, independent productions. One of them won the Oscar as a short the year before. So I wasn't quit. I certainly didn't go in there looking for a lawsuit. And the first thing that came to mind when I realized this was in clear violation of the law was not to file a lawsuit. I originally was hoping to find other people in the industry eager or at least interested in pursuing some kind of watchdog groups and sort of self-policing best practices standard. But I just found most people weren't interested. So once enough time had passed and I realized, you know, this problem wasn't going to go away. And even if I filed a small claim on my own, it wouldn't make a dent. It would be a nuisance cost of doing business check. So I decided, you know, the best way to do this would be, yeah, burn a bridge. Hmm. But by taking it to federal court and pursuing a class action, making it so prominent that, for example, you are having a show with me on it to discuss the issue. Because I figured the only way this is ever going to change is if a lot of people hear about it. And if employers basically become too frightened to continue engaging in this illegal practice.
Well, let's talk about the repercussions. You were part of this lawsuit against Fox. You won.
Mm.
You're on the radio show now. But are you seeing other interns stepping forward saying, hey, we can't work like this? And are you seeing companies saying, okay, we got to back off on this intern thing?
Yeah, I've already seen reports online of different companies who, since we filed the suit and even since the judgment itself, have publicly stated they're changing their policies. More often, companies change their policies and don't say anything publicly about it because, honestly, they're still liable for back pay, you know, depending on the state, for X number of years. So if they were to say, oh, yeah, this practice is probably not kosher, we're going to change it, they're basically opening themselves up to being sued for the time, you know, the period of time before they made the change. So most of the change happens very quietly. However, I have seen a lot more interns coming forward on their own. And also, you know, I'm part of an Occupy-related working group that started called Intern Labor Rights. And we're plugged in now with advocacy groups in 7 or 8 different countries pushing for this, both in the nonprofit sector, the for-profit sector, and the governmental sector. In fact, there's a strike scheduled for Wednesday outside the EU. The interns are going to hold a strike.
So, Eric, as interns are trying to build their resumes, trying to make themselves look desirable to employers, and their parents are thinking about bankrolling these experiences, what questions should they all be asking themselves before they go into any internship?
Well, I mean, one of the questions they should ask themselves is, if they take this internship and it actually amounts to an employer giving away someone else's job, what job do they expect to be waiting for them when they graduate college? Because what's happening is employers are becoming accustomed to the fact that they can get relatively inexperienced labor for free by calling it an intern. And they don't care if it's a student or a recent graduate. People, if you remember the pilot for the episode, for the HBO series Girls, you know, the whole premise of the show, it gets started because she's doing serial unpaid internship work, and her parents finally pulled the rug out from under, pulled the plug on her, on supporting her. This is taking away jobs from a whole generation that is right now experiencing double-digit unemployment. The average starting wage for someone just out of college today is lower than it was in the year 2000. And by participating in these programs that are enabling employers to cut their payroll, they're actually undermining their own ability to get work when they graduate. In terms of whether their rights are being violated, the real question is, are they doing work that otherwise a paid employee would have to do? Because if they are, that's probably not in compliance with the law, and they may have a good case to file a lawsuit, or at least to bring it to their employer's attention. I've heard of people pointing to stories about this lawsuit to their employer where they had good terms, and the employer began paying them. So, you know, basically step one is just to be informed, and hopefully if you do have that kind of good dialogue, you can bring it to your employer's attention.
We're speaking with Eric Glatt, plaintiff in the Glatt versus Fox Searchlight Pictures case about the ethics and the values of internships. We're going to check the headlines, latest news, and then we'd like to hear from you. Have you or your children worked as interns? Did you find it valuable, or did you feel like they're getting free labor out of you? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tell us what you think at the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with intern labor activist Eric Glatt about the ethics and value of internships. And we'd love to hear from you. Have you or your children worked as interns, and what did you get out of it? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. And we're going to go right to the phones now and take our first call from Gail in Prairie du Chien. Hey, Gail.
Yes. I'm a retired probation and parole agent with the state of Wisconsin, and I loved interns. We used them. They were unpaid, of course, because the state couldn't part to pay them. But a lot of agents wouldn't take the responsibility of them because you had to watch them like a hawk. You had to, but we'd like to say a 6-week, 8-week internship. The first 2 weeks, you're just teaching them what to do, everything, and they follow you around and they do everything. And then after a couple of weeks, they can start to do a few little tasks for you. Yes, they helped me out. They did tasks for me. They did reports, that kind of thing. But they were supervised all the way. And at the end of the internship, they could almost be hired as an agent. And a lot of them were hired as agents or limited term employees because we let them do the gamut. They got to find out maybe it wasn't important. Maybe the job, they didn't like the job at all because we would expose them to the good and bad stuff.
Right. So it sounds like you guys were pretty conscientious, and it sounds like it was sort of a win-win scenario. Eric, is that what an internship is supposed to look like?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it sounds like, it sounds like it was a government agency, which plays a role. The government allows themselves to do that anyway. But yeah, I mean, it sounds to me like it was a supervised, structured program. You know, the problem is right now the law doesn't require any kind of affirmative way that employers do that kind of thing. It basically leaves it up to the interns to raise a red flag if they think there's a violation. So while that program sounds like it might be a model, what I want to see is some kind of support network or some kind of laws in place so that more internships look like that and it's harder to violate those principles.
Do you see that kind of law coming into being now that you're getting more attention to this issue?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because right now the law says it really should be there. You know, the only exemption would be if you qualified for the Supreme Court case. The problem is there's really lack of oversight. You know, you really can't rely on the Department of Labor to police companies, and companies aren't required to file paperwork in favor of why they should have an unpaid internship and why how it complies with the law at the front end. What the law basically says now is if you've got a problem, you have to be the lowest person on the totem pole, the person with the least advantage, that is the intern, has to file a complaint. And I think that, that's putting a very heavy burden on the person least equipped to shoulder it.
All right. Well, so, thank you. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I don't know that that law is coming, but I certainly think it's called for.
All right. Well, thank you to Gail for her call. And next we go to Teresa in Tomahawk. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. I have a question. I'm not quite sure if this falls under the line, but I work in the beauty industry, the hair salon industry, big manufacturers, Matrix, Paul Mitchell, Sassoon. Many hairdressers will ask for training or get training or even sometimes pay for training by the manufacturer. And then the manufacturer has that intern go out and work hours and hours and hours for free, using the auspice of, well, you are now one of our educators, and if you want to go to the next level, you have to do all these hours free. So it's kind of like they're an intern, but yet they're not getting paid. Or sometimes they'll say, well, if you have so many hours, we'll allow you to go to another training seminar. So I'm not sure if this falls under the line or not.
It's interesting, Teresa. Let's see what Eric has to say. What do you think, Eric?
That doesn't sound very promising to me. That sounds like somebody taking advantage of the fact that people are really desperate to get those kinds of experiences. And, you know, it's become so normalized to think. That's one reason why, you know, whether you call them interns or not, why I find this so problematic is it's become so normalized. So people now expect to have to give away labor for X period of time before they expect to be paid for it. So, I mean, to me, what was just described sounds like a corporation figuring out a way to get labor out of people for a while they're picking up a set of job skills. Is that right?
Yep, that sounds like that's what Teresa's saying.
Yeah, it doesn't sound good to me. I mean, I think the only way that they might make some kind of argument is if they said they were more freelancers or independent contractors rather than employees. I would be really curious to see someone bring that case to your regional Department of Labor office and to see what someone there has to say about it.
I think it sounds like a great idea.
Okay, well, thank you for that call, Teresa. And Eric, we've talked a lot about what internships shouldn't look like. What should they look like?
Well, I mean, when I graduated college, I don't think I'd even heard the term. So first thing I would say is no employer has to have an intern. There's no legal obligation to have them because I've heard some people ask me the question, well, if they're not going to do work, what do you want me to do with them? It's like, well, either you pay them or don't have them. but, you know, a good internship program in compliance with the law, and then maybe that is legitimately in that intern's long-term interest, is something that looks like a formal training program that has instruction and hands-on supervision and relatively short-term. It shouldn't be something that goes on for months and months and months because that really that's just a form of unemployment. And it should be focused exclusively on the trainee and what they get out of it.
We have a comment from Karen on Facebook. She writes, my son has 2 years of experience as an unpaid intern for various non-governmental organizations and the U.S. government. I'm convinced, she writes, our country runs solely on unpaid 20-somethings. Is she overstating the case there?
No, I think that's a huge problem. And again, it goes to the fact that this has become so normalized now. People have both young adults and their employers just look at young adult labor and immediately dismiss its value as if somehow it's not providing the employer with something that's beneficial. And it's degrading, actually. And I think to this problem of the government doing it, it just basically gives the whole practice the patina of legitimacy. Happily, I'm now on the board of a campaign called the Fair Pay Campaign. It's going to launch in August. And our main target is the government and getting the government out of the free labor business. It's unconscionable for the wealthiest society in the history of humanity not to be able to pay people to do the people's work.
In terms of education, where do colleges stand on the whole internship thing? I mean, it seems like it's become standard for people to go off during one of their college years and get a couple of prestigious internships under their belt, and that colleges like that.
Unfortunately, I would like to say that colleges have really stepped into the breach here. Unfortunately, they've done quite the opposite. They've taken what could be an arguably legitimate, argument in favor of experiential learning, that there's something valuable about learning, not only in the classroom, but also in vocational environments, which may be a very legitimate argument to make. But by rubber stamping this practice, this ad hoc practice with little supervision, little standardization, different policies from department to department within the university, let alone between universities, all they've done is turned it into a free-for-all, opened up a spigot of free labor for employers, and basically, sort of wiped their hands of any responsibility. And it's really, really unconscionable. They're undermining the very job market their students are meant to graduate into.
Now, Eric, I don't know if there's the data out there on this, but I'd like to get your impression. So we've got two people going into one of these culture industries, Hollywood or maybe software. One says, I'm going to take this free internship, unpaid internship, work my butt off and see where I get. One says, no, I'm going to hold off and hold out until I can get a paying gig. Who does life come out better for?
Well, it's interesting. The National Association of Colleges and Employers, NACE, has done some studies, as has another organization called Intern Bridge. They're among the few really comprehensive studies out there. They're mostly focused on college student internships, not like the kind I did after graduating. But the studies seem to suggest that, A, certain industries pay their interns to begin with, like computer engineers and software companies, generally speaking. But also, the studies show that people who do paid internships tend to get a higher paying job after they graduate than people who did not do a paid internship. But also, people who did not do a paid internship tend to get better paying jobs after they graduate college than people who did unpaid internships. And I think part of that might be both a reflection of those kind of industries and also a reflection of the fact that you're basically signaling to the labor market that you don't think what you have to provide is worth anything either. So in a sense, yeah, those people holding out and going to the paying internship economic sectors are signaling that they believe what they're doing has more value, and it's working out for them.
Eric, we've got less than a minute to go, but I got to know, you tried to get into the film industry through Fox Searchlight. You've done some documentary work. Mm-hmm. That wasn't the career path you were going for. Now we're referring to you as an intern labor activist. So your mm-hmm. career track, it's really changed. How is your vocational life working out thanks to what's happened?
Yeah, I basically came off the fence of my agnosticism about the way the economy works and decided to throw my hat in the ring and do something about it. So in addition to this lawsuit, I've also enrolled in law school. I just finished my first year at Georgetown. And, you know, I'm now setting my sights on both the government internship programs, but also just people who are unpaid and underpaid, who provide legal services to the poor and other people who can't afford legal services they really need to get a fair shake in this society.
Eric, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you again for having me on the air.
That's Eric Glatt, intern labor activist now, plaintiff in the Glatt versus Fox Searchlight Pictures case.
Next is the news, and then we'll talk about the possibility of the government pressing federal charges against George Zimmerman. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Be sure to follow us on the Central Time Facebook page. You can also find Central Time WPR on Twitter. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.